This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. When writer Liza Alther is confused by something, she sits down and writes a novel about it. This happened when she found out that one of her ancestors in eastern Tennessee claimed to be Portuguese and Indian. Liza couldn't quite understand how Portuguese people got to Appalachia. And then her sister let it slip that their grandfather might have been Melungeon, a triracial people whose origins are unknown. Liza spent a decade researching immigration and race relations in Appalachia before writing her new novel, Washed in the Blood. It starts in the 1500s and ends in the middle of the 20th century, and along the way it fills out the Appalachian stories of Spanish and Portuguese immigrants, fur traders, farmers, merchants, Quakers, and the Eastern Band of the Cherokee. Liza Alther's in town this week to appear at several Triangle bookstores, but first she joins us in the studio. Liza, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Nice to be here. Thank you, Frank.
Let's start out with your own family history. You grew up in Kingsport, Tennessee. Now, what kind of town is Kingsport?
Kingsport was founded about 1915 as an industrial base for northern industries after Reconstruction. So it was a very interesting town because it was such a mixture of people. The managers of the factories came mostly from the north or from southern cities, and the workers came from the farms and hills of Appalachia. So it was a fascinating place to grow up in.
And actually was formed sort of in the industrial age, in those beginning years of the industrial age.
Yes, they called it the Model City, and they created it from scratch, you know, with a town plan and laid it all out.
So when did the mystery of your family origins begin for you?
I think it was when I was a little kid, and we had a babysitter from the country, and my brothers and I, when we would misbehave, she'd say, "The Melungeons are going to get you." And so we asked her who the Melungeons were, and she said they lived in caves outside our town and had six fingers on each hand. So they became kind of like the boogeyman for us, and I checked under my bed to be sure that there weren't Melungeons at night. So when I grew up, I wanted to find out who they were. And
it turns out there are people called the Melungeons. They're not the folks that were described in your imagination.
But right,
there are
right.
Melungeons, yeah.
Well, it set me off on a quest to try to figure out who the Melungeons really were and where they had come from and whether or not my ancestors had actually been Melungeons or not.
And tell us about the Melungeons.
Well, they were in the – I read everything I could get my hands on, which wasn't very much in the 1970s. And they were supposedly living in East Tennessee when the first European settlers arrived. They had darker complexions. Olive was the term used, which I thought was green. But and they were had certain distinctive surnames. The most common were Mullins, Goins, Collins, Bowling, Gibson, Bunch, several others. And their epicenter for settlement was in Hancock County, Tennessee, which is just west of where I grew up.
And was there much speculation about their ethnic origins?
Yes, there were a lot of legends that had grown up. They were said to be descended from Portuguese sailors who had shipwrecked along the Carolina coast or from the remnants of Sir Walter Raleigh's lost colony on Roanoke Island or from deserters from Hernando de Soto's exploring party. But most academics classified them as triracial isolates, meaning a combination of European, Native American, and African. And there's supposedly some 200 of those groups along the eastern third of the United States.
And then you also found out that there was a young Quaker that you might be related to.
Yes. Supposedly, our Phipps family was supposed to be descended from a Philadelphia Quaker, but I'm not so sure the more I look into his ancestry. But the Quaker in my book, I found it on, actually, he was a Dutchman who came to New Amsterdam. His name was Cornelius Vanover, and he moved to Ashe County, North Carolina, in the 18th century and married a native woman. So a part of my book is based on trying to figure out what that would have been like for him to leave an urban setting and come to the wilds of North Carolina.
And then there's the mystery of about your grandparents. They seem to you a kind of mysterious.
Well, they moved to this new town, Kingsport, in 1919. My grandfather was a doctor, and he came to Kingsport to open a hospital. But the strange thing about them was they grew up in southwestern Virginia. Each of them had seven brothers and sisters and lots of aunts and uncles and nieces and nephews and cousins, but we never met any of them. So as I got older, I realized how strange that was. And it sent me back to southwestern Virginia to meet a lot of my cousins and to try to excavate the story.
What did you learn about him?
About my grandparents?
About, yeah.
Well, my grandfather was an orphan and was taken in by his sister and then by two of his brothers. And he had a very difficult early life. He became a teacher. He met my grandmother, who was also studying to be a teacher, and they married, but they turned out to be second cousins. They had never met each other. So that was one of the things that I learned about that I guess they didn't want us to know because we never heard it. And I learned also that there was some Native American ancestry there, which didn't suit my grandmother's sense of herself as a She did a makeover and became a Tidewater aristocrat.
I see. And so one of the things you want to do is stay away from the relatives. So not all these secrets stay secret.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's talk about the book now. Washed in the Blood is sweeping. It's got it covers the period from the 1500s into the 20th century. A series of linked novellas. Tell us about the first one.
The first novella.
First novella.
The first novella is set in the 16th century, and it's based on my curiosity about my four times great grandmother that you mentioned, who said she was Portuguese Indian. I was trying to figure out how Portuguese ended up in the southern Appalachians. And so I had to go all the way back to Portugal. My main character is a hog drover, a 16-year-old boy who, for various reasons, gets sent on an exploring trip with a Spanish conquistador-like group. Who were traveling up from roughly Parris Island, South Carolina, up through the mountains of North Carolina and East Tennessee. And it's roughly based on an exploring group led by a Portuguese soldier named Juan Pardo in 1567. So everything in it is based on fact. I relied as much on fact as I could, and then where there were gaps, I had to use my imagination.
So there's the story of Diego Martin, based loosely on Juan Pardo's real-life story, to the extent that we know it. The second novella, who do we meet there?
The second one is the one that's based on the Quaker from Philadelphia, who's very loosely based on my ancestor from New Amsterdam, who came to Ashe County and married a Native woman. This character's named Daniel Hunter, and he is sent by his Quaker meeting, to this area, this mountainous area, which in my imagination is roughly where North Carolina, Virginia, and Tennessee all come together up there in the mountains. And by this time, there's a small town there, but everyone in it is illiterate. So his meeting sends him there to start a school. And all the people in the town are the descendants of my original young man, the hog drover. They don't know it, but the reader does. And they have been involved with the Native Americans in the fur trade. They worked for the English fur traders from the Virginia coast. And the fur trade has collapsed, and now they're all small farmers living in this area.
And of course, they as you say, their own history is somewhat obscured from them. These things just happen, and there they are. The readers know. Would you read for us now?
Sure.
And maybe you can set this up for us.
Okay. Well, this is a section from the second section we were just talking about. It's called The Five Chicken Baby, and it's set in 1818, and it introduces the young woman that my Quaker eventually marries, and it's her birth. Dr. Moore's horse staggered up Silver Valley, Doc's belly propped on the pommel like an overripe pumpkin. Struggling down from the saddle, he crossed the porch and opened the Martin's oak door. The main room was crammed to its ceiling beams with the five Martin sons, their father Reuben and their grandfather Zachariah, all awaiting the arrival of the new baby currently dawdling in Barbary's womb. Waving to the men, Doc lumbered into the bedroom, greeted Barbary, and parted her knees to inspect her progress. After washing up in a basin on the washstand, he returned to the other room where a dozen plucked chickens sizzled on a spit in the stone walk-in fireplace. Reuben removed a roaster and laid it in a pottery bowl and extended the bowl to Doc. Doc carried it out to the front porch, sat in a rocker, and started dismembering it. Now and then he called through the open window into the bedroom, "Y'all right in there, Barbary, honey?" Once he had sucked the grease off the bones and tossed them to the hounds lurking in the yard, he lay back in the chair and began to snooze. As the sun sank behind a cliff and a cool blue shadow stole across the pasture, a contraction hit Barbary so hard that she howled like a trapped wolf. Doc snapped awake and heaved himself to his feet. Examining her again, he murmured, "It's going to be a while yet, Barbary." "Doc, I don't think I can stand it no more," she gasped. "'Pears to me you got no choice," he replied cheerfully. "I watch them come and I watch them go, and life just plods along at its own pace, whether we like it or not." As Doc lingered by the fire, Reuben offered him another chicken. Returning to the porch, Doc devoured the second of what he hoped would be the entire flock. Then he licked his fingers clean, picked his teeth with his thumbnail, clasped his hands atop his belly, and fell into a deep slumber that even a mosquito feasting on his billowing chins didn't disturb. Toward midnight, as the moon bathed the pasture in a pale golden glow, Reuben prodded Doc awake. He came to with a jerk and a snort, rose slowly to his feet, and stumbled into the house, tiptoeing with sudden cat-like grace around the sons, sprawled fast asleep on the floor. Doc eyed the three remaining chickens now nesting in a crock on the trestle table. Barbary lay writhing in the four-poster bed, her teeth clenched and her hair slick with sweat, but Doc soon placed in her arms a tiny girl with an olive face, curly charcoal hair, and bewildered black eyes. On each miniature hand was a second thumb. "Have mercy, Barbary," he exclaimed. "Have you been locked in forbidden embraces with those Indians across the mountain?" "Lord, no," she said, smiling down at the baby. "I don't even like it with Reuben, much less with rank strangers. In fact, I aim to give it up now. I can't go through all this again. I'm way too old. It'd like to kill me this time around." "I've heard that before," said Doc, "after almost every delivery I've ever done, but a year or two later they all come looking for me again." "Well, not me. This is it for me." Back in the other room, Reuben said, "Doc, we sure do appreciate you, but I ain't got no more than a few coins to pay you with." "I'll take the roasters for the balance, Reuben." Doc departed, grease soaking through a sack across one shoulder. Reuben went in to inspect his first daughter, the fruit of aged loins. He cradled her in his arm, examining her delightedly. "Well, darling," he said, leaning down to give Barbary's damp forehead a kiss. "Looks like Doc gave us a bargain this time, a five-chicken baby."
Washed in the Blood, Liza Alther is the author of this novel, three novellas in a sense, but it becomes a novel. So the idea that race mixing produces extra thumbs, and that was sort of inherent in this passage.
What I found in my research is that actually extra fingers are much more commonly found in Native American communities than in any other. So it's generally been regarded as a result of inbreeding, but I found in my research that it's more like a marker for Native American ancestry. And there are places in Turkey where there are people with extra fingers, and they would have had the same ancestry as the Native Americans. So I think it's a genetic characteristic of Central Asians.
Now, the third section of this identity and race come into play, both identity and race. It's the Jim Crow era South. Tell us about the final novella.
The third section, which is, as I say, was loosely based on my grandparents, the little town from the second section has grown much bigger. The trading post for the farmers has become a five and dime. It's early in the 19th century. the Martin family has split into two sections, largely because of the Civil War. The merchants in the town were Confederates, and the moonshiners up on the ridge were Union. So there's been an atrocity that's occurred during the Civil War that has alienated the two branches from one another to such an extent that the two branches don't even realize that they're related. The branch in town has invented origin myths in which they come from the Virginia Tidewater and are descended from Confederate cavaliers, and they want nothing to do with the riffraff up on the ridge. So a boy from the ridge falls in love with a girl from town. It's kind of a Romeo and Juliet scenario.
Hatfields and McCoys, too.
Hatfield and McCoys, yeah. Right.
So just briefly, and look at this. I've got 30 seconds left, but you did a lot of research. You've got the three very profound stories that are wonderful stories, all related. Did you see them as separate stories, or could you feel, were they always related in your mind?
They were always related in my mind. I wanted it to be many generations of one family and have the family be the main character, in a sense.
Liza, pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, Frank.
Liza Alther is the author of the new novel, Washed in the Blood. She reads tonight at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh, 7:30. Going to be at the Regulator in Durham tomorrow, McIntyre's in Farrington Village on the 4th, and Flyleaf in Chapel Hill on the 5th. That's the State of Things for today. Thanks for listening. Our website is stateofthings.org, and this is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.